Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell Reed, my co-host Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Jan Thornhill. So Jan, your latest book, The Triumphant Tale of the House Sparrow, traces the history of the house sparrow through the ages. Where were these birds first recorded?
Well, they first evolved in the Middle East. I mean, we've found evidence of them there. There was another little sparrow that looked similar to them, but was not the house sparrow. So the little bird that we all know from towns and cities and sometimes farms that we don't see in the woods, the house sparrow, the most common irritating bird around because it only chirps. It doesn't have a song. It just goes chirp, 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 at starting at 5 o'clock in the morning usually. It actually evolved with humans, alongside humans, when humans started growing grain. It didn't exist before that, so it has always been a companion of humans.
Maybe became adaptable with them.
It's very adaptable.
Yeah. Okay, so you begin your book with a picture of the sparrow and the words, "Behold the most despised bird in human history." Why were they so despised?
Oh, and they still are by some people, but they are grain eaters. And when humans started farming,
you mean thieves?
They stole grain. That's right.
Yeah.
And they also are very successful breeders. They can have four, even five broods of young a year. They can have five babies each time. Yes, yeah, so they can multiply very, very quickly. And eat a lot of grain.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. I was thinking of the mothers, but I guess they grow up and go before the next lot comes along.
That's right.
How and why did they become such successful migrants, then, to countries all over the world? I mean, it's a long way from the Middle East to America, for instance.
Well, they started in the Middle East, and then they just, which is where agriculture began.
Yeah.
And as agriculture spread from there to North Africa and into Europe and over into India, the sparrows just moved along with them.
So
there's actually another sparrow called the Eurasian tree sparrow, which is a very close cousin, and it lives in Asia, in China, and it has the same role there. It lives by humans and it eats grain.
So did they come to America last? Do we know when they moved into America?
Well, they didn't move by themselves into America. I'll read a little bit about that later.
Oh, okay, great.
But they also were brought. They were introduced to North America, to South America, to some of the Caribbean islands, to Australia. So they're all over the world. They're on every continent except Antarctica.
Very sensible. It's cold down there. Please tell us some of the greatest challenges they've overcome then. How are the house sparrows doing after this long history?
Their numbers are dropping in some places, but there's still 2 billion of them on the planet. The concern is that we don't know why their numbers are dropping. It could have to do with pesticides. The house sparrow feeds its young primarily, almost solely, insects for the first week of their lives. The rest of the time they eat grain. So if there's not enough insects, then the babies will not thrive. It could have something to do with people paving their front yards and no longer having flowers, weeds being removed everywhere so they don't have seeds in the winter to eat, because they eat lots and lots of weed seeds. There's all kinds of possibilities. Even cell towers possibly interfering with their ability to judge distances or direction. We don't know yet.
All sort of rather modern things.
Yes, so modern things and modern things that their cohorts as humans have been affecting.
Yes. Well, how about reading from The Triumphant Tale of the House Sparrow?
Well, I'd love to. So this is about the introduction of the house sparrow to North America. They just naturally spread around Europe and over there, but they were actually brought to North America. By the 1800s, despite continuing efforts to control it, Europe was overrun with the house sparrow. It was everywhere, in every barnyard, on every sidewalk, in every market, in every backyard, nesting in every crevice, including between the legs of gargoyles. It was even daringly stealing food from animals in zoos. In many parts of the world, though, such as Australia and the Americas, there were no house sparrows. There were, however, new cities in these places that week by week swelled with more and more European immigrants. Some immigrants, mostly city folk, were homesick for the cheerful chirping of the house sparrow they had grown up with. Some people missed the familiar little bird so much that they came up with the bright idea of capturing some in Europe and letting them go in New York City. Surely the house sparrow could survive in America. It seemed to be able to thrive anywhere. And perhaps it would even take care of the plagues of caterpillars that stripped the city trees of their leaves each summer. The first few attempts to introduce it failed. But then, in 1852, 50 pairs were released in a Brooklyn cemetery in the early spring. This time, the introduction of an alien species took, and in less than 10 years, all of New York's boroughs had sparrows galore. People in other American cities wanted the house sparrow, too, so they brought in their own breeding populations, or got some birds from New York. Conditions in America were so perfect for the house sparrow that it had no problem raising one brood after another wherever it was introduced. And so it multiplied, and multiplied, and multiplied, and spread. Some even hitched rides across the country on railway cattle cars. Grain was plentiful everywhere, largely because horses were everywhere. On farms and in towns and cities, the house sparrow snapped up every oat that spilled from a feed bag. It even pecked undigested grain from manure. And though it turned its beak up at tree-stripping caterpillars, there was no shortage of tastier insects to feed its young. Better still, native birds weren't yet used to farms and cities, so the house sparrow had little competition for nesting sites and food. Basically, America was house sparrow heaven. At least it was for a while. At first, everyone was delighted. It was just so grand to live in cities enlivened by such a familiar and entertaining bird. In several parks, elaborate sparrow apartment buildings were even built to encourage it to breed so there would be lots of sparrows for people to enjoy. In less than 20 years, though, it became difficult to find a park bench anywhere that wasn't whitewashed with sparrow droppings. The din at dawn when thousands of them started chirping, and in the evening before they settled down for the night, was deafening. The house sparrow was also a bully. On the edges of towns and on farmsteads, it stole feed from chickens and drove away native birds. It even ejected eggs and young from tree swallow and bluebird nesting holes that it wanted for itself. And in farm fields, it did what it had always done. It attacked crops. A battle cry arose. The house sparrow had to be stopped. Pros and cons appeared in newspapers across the land. Name-calling began. The house sparrow was called a villain, a cuss, a disreputable character, a glutton and a parasite. It was impudent, insolent, irascible, irritable, intolerable, and lazy. It even caused fires. In Pittsburgh, it lined its nests with fluff from the cotton mill that ignited when sparks from the iron mill landed on them. "But wait," said others, "they're so cheerful, so frolicsome, so amusing and entertaining, and the children love them. And what would happen if they didn't eat the seeds of weeds and feed their nestlings insect pests like grasshoppers, caterpillars, and beetles?" The American Sparrow Wars had begun.
Oh.
Ominous.
So many thanks, Jan, for coming in and telling us about your writing career and your latest book, which sounds absolutely fascinating. So where can listeners buy your books?
Oh, as they say, at better bookstores everywhere.
Okay. And locally, they can buy them at our bookstore in Coburg, huh?
I would hope so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, good.
And so will you be having a launch for the triumphant tale of the
It's actually been out since April, so last April, so...
You had one.
I didn't actually.
No?
No. Maybe I should still.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
Come to Coburg and have it here.
Ah.
Sure you'd get a crowd.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. So to connect with Gwyn and me, please send comments on the program, queries or suggestions for who we might interview in future programs to us at our website, wordonthehills.com, where all these shows are archived and available to listeners at any time. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for another program next week.